UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, presents Chernobyl, Some Lessons Learned.
Two explosions in Reactor 4 at the Chernobyl power station in the Ukraine on the 26th of April 1986 caused the biggest civilian nuclear disaster man has known. Radioactive particles carried by wind were spread all over Europe, and an area of 30 kilometers around the accident site had to be evacuated. Some 4 million people were directly or indirectly affected by the disaster. A much larger quantity of radioactive matter was spread through the water cycle in rivers, lakes and seas, and via snow, fog, rain and groundwater. The movement of radioactive particles is slower in water than it is in the atmosphere, but it is harder to monitor, detect and control. How does this contamination accumulate? What damage does it cause? And what sort of hazards does it present to our environment in the future? These are some of the questions that scientists from Europe, the CIS, the USA and Israel tried to answer at a recent workshop organized by UNESCO in Paris. Entitled Hydrological Impact of Nuclear Power Plant Systems, the meeting examined the post-Chernobyl scenario and urged that some pre-Chernobyl concepts, especially relating to safety procedures and to the siting of nuclear power plants, be reviewed and modified. Professor Jay Hilton of the Windermere Laboratory in the United Kingdom is the coordinator of the European Program on Freshwater Ecology. He has done extensive work in England's Lake District, monitoring the fallout of the Chernobyl accident in Britain. I asked him about the overall impact of the Chernobyl accident.
There are many problems that we don't understand, or we're only just starting to understand after the Chernobyl accident. The Chernobyl accident was much more severe than most people usually consider, and it spread much further than most people considered, and a whole range of different environments were affected, so it's been quite difficult to put all that information together and make sense of it. We're learning slowly.
It's now been proved that it's the waterborne contamination which causes a greater problem.
Well, you can't deal with airborne contamination. All you can do is watch it move. But there are models which are quite sophisticated which will model that movement, which were improved after Chernobyl, and it's relatively straightforward to monitor that. It's much more difficult to predict what's going to happen in a river system, because in a large river basin, there will be many different soils which will react chemically with the radioactive material in different ways. And so sometimes it will be held in the soil, other times it won't be held in the soil, and so different parts of the river will receive different amounts of radioactivity from the same atmospheric deposition. And so there's a large variability in the soil response, which then feeds into the rivers.
So what are the most dangerous agents from the point of view of human safety?
Well, the main isotopes of concern in the longer term from an accident like the Chernobyl accident would be radioactive cesium-137 and radioactive strontium-90, because they exist for a relatively long time in the environment and they are part of the human diet. They can be incorporated into the human body quite relatively easily, and so they are much more dangerous than other things which are not incorporated in the same way or remain for a relatively short time in the environment, because after all, radioactive materials means that they decay, they break down, they disappear. So if you have a radioactive material which has what we call a short half-life, iodine-125, will only exist perhaps tens of days in the environment before it disappears, it's decayed. It's only the ones that don't decay quickly that we have to worry about. Each half-life, you lose half of what was there before. Cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years, and strontium-90, I can't remember offhand, but it's about the same sort of time, I think, the 30-year sort of period.
Oh, so the 30-year cycle can go on for several hundreds of years before it eventually completely disappears.
Yes. But it, obviously there will be a level at which it's not a risk in the environment, and that will be considerably closer to the event than the time at which it's unmeasurable in the environment.
Now, you are an ecologist. Has your perception of nuclear energy changed after the Chernobyl accident?
I hadn't really had any experience of work with radioactive materials before the Chernobyl accident. We used it particularly as a tracer of processes. And I guess before the Chernobyl accident, before I became involved, I was fairly sceptical of the nuclear industry. I guess I would be among those people who would say we don't want any more nuclear power. But now I've become more involved with the nuclear power industry. I realise that there are extremely knowledgeable people there. They know what they're talking about. And I'm now quite happy that nuclear power should make up part of the energy resource that we make use of. The big gap is the acceptance by the general public who don't have the access to specialists like I do.
Have the hydrologists who are present here and nuclear scientists evolved any guidelines? Are you moving towards any kind of recommendations about where future nuclear power stations should be located if certain criteria have to be taken into consideration?
This is one of the aspects of the recommendations for this meeting. There are recommendations already. The idea of this meeting is to take the information from the Chernobyl accident and to feed that back into the system and make improved recommendations on the basis of our findings after the Chernobyl accident.
So what would you generally say if you were to give a cautioning word to someone who plans to set up a nuclear power station?
There are a whole series of experts there, all with their own particular ideas on what should be included. If I talk about my own speciality, which is water transport processes, then the Chernobyl accident showed us in our region that peat bogs, wetland areas, are very susceptible and they will tend to release cesium back into the system. So I would say don't build a power station near a peat bog. Similarly, we find that concentrations of radioactive nuclides in fish in the Cumbrian area of the UK are about the same sort of levels as the radioactivity in fish in the Kiev reservoir immediately close to the reactor. And it's a difference in water quality. The water in the Kiev reservoir is relatively hard. The water in the Cumbrian area is very soft. And so there needs to be some consideration of the water quality within the area of the reactor. And again, I would say don't build a reactor in an area which has soft water. Build it in an area that has hard water because the system can cope better.
One of the issues which was stressed by practically every scientist at the meeting was that of safety. What are the lessons to be learned from Chernobyl? I asked Professor Peter Richter of the Department of Atomic Physics at Budapest Technical University what had changed since Chernobyl.
In each country there exist emergency plans and complete facilities for doing emergency actions and monitoring. However, all these have been based on previous theoretical assumptions. Now, Chernobyl has occurred now for quite a few years, and there has been no revision of these events on this basis, and now it has become clear that there are certain points that must be reconsidered. I think one of the significant concepts that have been previously assumed are that such an accidental event is instantaneous when situation changes suddenly and then you have to respond to this sudden change. Now, the events in Chernobyl show that the accident main event lasted more than a week. Namely, there was continuous emission of radionuclides for a longer period of time. This means that you could not use emergency plan as if it was a sudden incident, but you had to re-evaluate the situation continuously and use kind of an adaptive action which takes into consideration the variation of the instantaneous situation. So I think one main aspect of changes that must be taken is that the emergency plans must have a flexible adaptive philosophy according to the measurements, according to the evaluation of the situation.
Coming back also to the location of nuclear plants, would you suggest any other safety measures?
Primary concern for sightings previously, I think, did not take into consideration danger which the hydrological system is faced from a possible accident. Therefore, I think very important issues are touched upon, and one of the other recommendations is that the whole siting and licensing procedure should be re-evaluated on the basis of its impact on the hydrological systems, because Chernobyl showed that the long term, and by long term I mean in terms of years, effects are mostly related to the water system. The airborne pollution is transported within a short time, and afterwards when it has been deposited, say, on the soil or water surfaces, that's where it remains for a longer time, that's where it is transported in an uncontrolled way by surface water. And of course, there is a very big concern of possible contamination of groundwater being the final resource of drinking water.
Now, in your point of view, what would you think needs to be bolstered up as concerns the safety factors?
One interesting point which came out for each country is that there are different authorities. For instance, in the case of hydrological systems, there is the authority responsible for water and the authority responsible for nuclear safety. I'm not talking about the detailed structures of these two authorities. And their cooperation, their understanding, their classification system, their communication system are not coordinated well enough. And this is one of those things where the determination of responsibility, determining who should take action, determining the way of communication, is extremely important. So I think in the very near future, one of the main steps in this organizational field is to create a better linkage between these authorities, because a real-life accident is not limited to one authority, but it is actually influencing the whole interdisciplinary aspect of human life, and actually this whole activity is in order to save human health and human life.
UNESCO's Chernobyl program began shortly after the disaster took place. At first, the projects took the shape of humanitarian aid. Since then, several scientific exchange programs have been organized by UNESCO. A notable feature of UNESCO's Chernobyl program is that it has brought together several voluntary and non-governmental organizations and raised extra budgetary funds to support the program. Bruno Lefebvre, who is in charge of UNESCO's Chernobyl program, gives us some details.
We have raised $4 million for the program. This comes from the European community. It comes from bilateral sources like Canada, the Netherlands, France, Belgium, etc. It also comes quite substantially from private foundations and non-profit organizations. And they are, not only are they giving money, but they also participate in implementing our programs. And this is very good, because UNESCO's mission is also to generate this kind of generosity and sympathy with this kind of problems.
The people who've been evacuated from the Chernobyl area are facing a whole series of problems. Luba Horic, a sociologist and psychologist, who will be setting up a UNESCO-sponsored center in the Ukraine, spoke to us about the problems she hopes to help resolve.
The mission is to set up or organize community rehabilitation centers for the people that have been evacuated from the Chernobyl area. And currently we are setting up one center just outside of Kiev, two centers just outside of Gomel, and one center just outside of Dinant. The interesting part about this project is that the centers are being set up not in the large cities, but in the actual communities where the people that have been evacuated to live. The goal of the center is to help the people that have been evacuated to deal with the stress, not just the stress of having lived through and survived the actual explosion, but also the stress of being evacuated, and the stress of leaving behind families, of interrupting family life. It's very interesting because in some situations when the people were evacuated, they were evacuated according to their lifetime radiation or how much radiation they would get in a lifetime, which means that the young people were evacuated, the older people were left behind because their lifetime evacuation won't be as heavy, which means that many of the families were separated. In a society where grandparents usually look after the children. And that creates a lot of stress. A lot of stress comes from the fact that most people give up usual activities. For example, in that part of those countries, one of the activities is collecting mushrooms in the woods, going for walks in the woods, swimming in the river, and all that is now forbidden or denied them. And another big stress comes from the fact that these people were evacuated into communities where other people already live. And currently, there is a difficulty because of lack of information, because people don't understand what's going on. Many of the local people, for example, don't want their children playing with the evacuated children because they believe that this radiation sickness is contagious. Which brings me to the other problem is that for many years now, these people have had no information about the real effects of radiation or misinformation. And over the years, they have developed an attitude that they don't believe anything. And so they're essentially functioning in a vacuum. They don't know. And what happens now is that every time anybody gets a cold, anytime anybody falls ill, immediately it's the radiation that has caused it. So the goal of the program is to give people information, to help them deal with the various stresses, to help parents deal with their children. Many of the parents, for example, won't allow the children to go outside to play at all due to fear of the radiation. So what we intend to do is to set up a community center that would have many activities. And through these activities, we can bring people together that they can A, intermingle the local community and the evacuees, and B, give them a chance to start discussing their stresses and their difficulties while there are going to be trained personnel to help them deal with it. And through the activities, later they can set up actual group sessions where people can work out their stress. There's a lot of anger there around the whole seven group, and these people have not worked out yet. And the other part of the program is we're going to attempt to put in good parent training programs so to help parents deal with the children. Besides the Chernobyl difficulty, there is also the whole change in the economic system, the change in the social system, which also creates a lot of stress because now parents aren't sure how to deal with their children anymore. So it's a project that combines different aspects together in order to create a community center where people can work on their rehabilitation and also learn how to handle other issues.
That was Chernobyl, Some Lessons Learned, prepared and presented by Baiju Naravne. The program was produced by Aaron Carati at UNESCO in Paris.